Scott threw the lever back to shower and twisted the knob all the way to cold. He had learned this trick in a massage club in Hong Kong. A hot bath, followed by a cold plunge, was better than 4 cups of coffee any day. The shock to his system had the desired effect, and Scott climbed out of the shower feeling alive, his senses keen, even if his body was still in pain. He promised himself no sedatives or pain medication, no matter what Hollenbeck or Dr. Trawick said. He hated how those things could cloud his mind, and his mind was his most important weapon. Gumming up the works was just asking for trouble. Not seeing his clothes lying around and figuring they had probably been cut off him, Scott was relieved to find a terrycloth bathrobe in the bedroom's cedar closet. He put it on and headed for the door. When he stepped into the hallway, he noticed the door across from his was wide open and the room's bed was made. He searched his brain for what Dr. Trawick had said about Amanda. Hadn't he said she was across the hall? If she had been, she had been moved, and Scott added her whereabouts to the list of questions he had. There were no detail agents in the hall as he made his way toward the stairway, but he did hear voices coming from below. Walking in a straight line across a level surface was one thing. Walking downstairs was another. Scott leaned heavily on the pine banister as he forced his knees to bend and accommodate. He let out a small thanks that none of the agents in the enormous picture-windowed living room had seen his struggle. After 3 shuffling steps at the bottom of the landing, he was spotted by Agent Palmer.
"What are you doing up, Scott?"
"I'm not paid to sleep, and I want to know what's going on."
"It's bad, real bad.
I heard Birdhouse talking with Hermes about finding 2 agents down last night."
"From what I heard, you took a real beating. Are you okay?"
"I'm fine," Scott growled, with a little more venom than Agent Palmer deserved.
"Would somebody just tell me what's going on? Have you eaten?"
"Palmer, damn it, I want to know what's happening."
"Listen to me, Scott. Just relax. A lot has happened, and I mean a lot. I'll be more than happy to fill you in. Why don't we get you some breakfast, and I'll tell you everything. You're going to need to sit down for this."
Palmer walked away for a moment toward the front door and returned carrying a blue duffel bag with a Secret Service emblem on the side.
"They had to cut you out of your clothes last night. Hollenbeck figured you might need some things, so he had one of the agents get this stuff from your hotel."
"He's all heart." "My hotel."
Scott still couldn't remember its name.
"There's a bathroom just down the hall there. Why don't you get dressed and meet me in the kitchen? I'll put some coffee on and see what I can rustle up food-wise."
"Thanks, Palmer."
"No prob."
20 minutes later, shaved and past the painful ordeal of getting dressed, Scott appeared in the kitchen, wearing jeans, a sweatshirt, and a pair of Timberland boots. Palmer was sitting on a stool at a granite-topped cooking island, reviewing paperwork. She looked up from a reading and saw Scott standing in the doorway.
"How are you doing?"
"Enough about me. Let's have some answers."
"You know, Harvath, I'm willing to cut you some slack for what you went through, but you're getting dangerously close to the limit."
"I know,"
Scott said, as he took the stool next to her, glad that it had a soft cushion he could rest his body against.
"I'm sorry. I just want to know what the big picture is."
"Fine. I can understand that. There's a lot to go over, so why don't I pour us each a cup of coffee and we'll get started. I hunted up a microwave breakfast, one of those eggs and bacon things. Probably doesn't taste too good."
"Sold. I'll take it."
With a cup of steaming hot coffee and a bland microwave breakfast to keep his mouth busy, he listened as Palmer explained what the Secret Service knew so far.
"At 1610 yesterday afternoon, you relayed Goldilocks' desire to call it a day. You met Hattrick's detail at the last lap, from which he proceeded with his detail toward Death Chute, and your detail accompanied Goldilocks toward her usual route back here. At approximately 1625, your report states that Goldilocks wiped out, and while you were retrieving her gear, you thought you noticed Ahern and Houchins fall, going into the treed area of Death Chute. It was at this point that you noticed communications—"
"Palmer," said Scott between bites of hash browns, "can you please skip ahead to the stuff I don't know? Give me the abridged version."
"You know, I could just let you sift through the reports."
"Don't give me a hard time. Give me the facts."
All right, all right. Your team didn't make it.
None of them?
We've recovered 5 members of your detail already and are looking for the others, who are now presumed dead. The 5 we've got were killed by the avalanche.
Scott hung his head and pinched the bridge of his nose, trying to fight off the headache and emotion he felt coming on.
And Goldilocks, what's her condition?
He asked without looking up.
She suffered some severe head and neck trauma, frostbite, and hypothermia. Had you not gotten her out of the snow and the intercept team not found you when they did, she never would have made it. Her condition is guarded but stable. She has some damaged vertebrae, but they believe they can be fixed.
Will she be able to walk? Is there any permanent damage?
According to Dr. Paulus, there shouldn't be any permanent damage. It looks like she's going to pull through.
Thank God for that. What about Hattrick?
That's where it gets really bad. Every member of Hattrick's detail is dead.
Dead? How?
9mm, best we can tell.
Scott couldn't believe what he was hearing and sat up ramrod straight.
What? They were all taken out?
All of them.
Palmer paused for a moment to let it sink in before continuing.
We had several jars, as you know, in the trees along that part of Death Chute, and they were sanctioned as well.
What about Hattrick?
We don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
We haven't been able to recover his body.
Holy shit.
Despite the anger and sadness he felt, his years of training had taught him that when the time came, he would be able to grieve privately, but that for now, he needed to filter his emotions. What mattered was not how he felt, but how he thought.
So, Scott continued with amazing composure, the entire detail and the JAR team was sanctioned. There's no sign of Hattrick. I can't believe this. Somebody must have grabbed him.
We're not positive, but
you found all of the other bodies sanctioned, but not his? Sounds like he was grabbed to me. Have there been any demands?
Hold on. You are getting way ahead of things here.
Palmer, how am I getting ahead?
You found all the detail agents, but not Hattrick. They normally stick pretty close to him.
Yes, but this was an avalanche. He could have been swept in any direction.
Don't give me that. You know how this looks. If it was just an avalanche, that would be one thing. But his detail was terminated.
Scott, we're all in shock. Never in the history of the Secret Service have we lost so many agents protecting the president, nor has anyone ever succeeded in a kidnapping, which is how we're playing this.
So you do agree?
Yes.
Jesus, I can't believe this.
We do have one lead, though.
What kind of lead?
Harper managed to get off a shot and kill one of the people we believe were responsible for the attack.
Good old Harp, Scott thought to himself.
They left the body behind?
Who was it? What can you tell me?
We're waiting for confirmation on the identity. We've had to wire the prints and picture off to CIA station chiefs in the Mideast.
Sandland? You're telling me the job was carried out by a bunch of Bedouin Bobs? That's impossible. The only thing they know about snow is that it's spelled with 2 different letters than sand.
What I'm telling you is that we've got upward of 30 dead Secret Service agents, a missing president, and one deceased male of Mideastern descent found at the scene of the crime with a bullet in the back of his head that I'm betting dollars to donuts was fired from Sam Harper's SIG.
Scott put his elbows on the cold granite countertop and rested his head in his hands. He had to be dreaming. Soon he would wake up and this nightmare would be over. As he sat there with the microwave breakfast and coffee going sour in his stomach, the pieces began falling into place.
The failure in our communication systems wasn't caused by the weather then, was it?
We still don't know.
So, what's the status of our investigation? Are they gritting Death Chute and going through it millimeter by millimeter?
No.
No?
Scott asked incredulously.
What do you mean, no?
Scott, you put the pieces together just as fast as everyone else did. The president has been kidnapped, or worse, and that now makes this an FBI matter. We have been instructed to secure the area.
And that's it?
Yeah, that's it.
Who gave those orders?
It came from D.C. after Hollenbeck spoke with the director of the Secret Service. Agents from the Salt Lake FBI field office are already on site, waiting for the special agent in charge, who's going to handle the investigation. He's due in about an hour.
Scott groaned, knowing who it would be.
Let me guess. The SAC is Gary Lawler, right?
Yeah, the FBI's deputy director himself. Makes sense. The director's gonna have no choice but to stay in D.C. and coordinate. This is going to be one hell of a firestorm.
17. Harvath needed to clear his head. The information Palmer had relayed was overwhelming. Upward of 30 agents dead, and the president missing, presumed kidnapped. It was too much to grasp. Scott grabbed a blue and white Secret Service parka hanging by the back door of the kitchen and walked outside. Three agents taking a cigarette break looked in his direction but didn't say anything. What could be said? Harvath walked into the woods alongside the house, and when he felt he was out of sight of the other agents, leaned against one of the tall trees and closed his eyes. A million questions raced through his mind.
What happened? How could I have not seen this coming? Did I overlook something during the advance?
Every wacko in a 400-mile radius had been accounted for, the more dangerous of them locked up for the few days the president would be here. There hadn't been any pings on U.S. immigration hotsheets, and there had been no new threats from any extremist groups that had even hinted at this. He breathed deeply, letting the chilly air fill his lungs, and held it until it burned. Slowly, he let the air escape in a long hiss. He repeated the process again, trying to get a handle on what was going on.
Upward of 30 agents killed, and the president missing.
Scott began second-guessing himself, convinced that there had been some sort of warning sign that he'd missed. There were still agents out there trapped under the snow, but Palmer had been right. The chances that they were alive were slim to none. Scott fought back a surge of guilt. Many of those men had been his friends, and they all had been his responsibility.
Not now, a voice inside him said. Turn and let it burn.
But it was so hard. Even though he was trained to be a master of his mind and emotions, he was still human. He had lost comrades before, but it had been on missions to faraway places where he had been striking at threats to domestic or international security. Those men had fallen in battle, but this wasn't the same. These Secret Service agents never had a chance, never saw what was coming, and they had been hit on home turf. The thought of foreign insurgents executing this attack on American soil and then scooting back to wherever they came from, especially if it was Sandland, really pissed Scott off. Deep breathing out in the woods wasn't the road to the answers he wanted. Besides, his ribs were killing him. The answers would be found where the action was, up on Death Chute. Until Gary Lawler got here, the crime scene still belonged to the Secret Service. And as the leader of the presidential advance team, Scott felt he had not only a right, but a duty to examine every inch of it.
What are you, nuts? Said a young FBI agent from the Salt Lake field office when Harvath ducked under the tape and started making his way to the scene.
Scott had hitched a ride up with a snowcat that was hauling equipment as close as it could get to the plateau, where a combination of Secret Service and FBI agents were acting as Sherpas, walking the gear the rest of the way to the crime scene.
Listen, agent.
Scott looked at the identification tag hanging around the man's muscled neck.
Zushnit, I need to get in there and take a look around.
The man had about 3 inches and a good 75 pounds on Scott, but Scott had messed with bigger guys and come out on top. The FBI agent was in no mood to deal with Harvath. His orders were to let no one in until Lawler got there, and he intended to make sure those orders were carried out.
This is a crime scene under the jurisdiction of the FBI. No one goes in there except FBI. Capiche?
Capiche? Where did a Salt Lake Fed with a name like Zushnit pick up capiche? Scott wondered.
His need to get answers turned the flame up on his anger a couple of notches.
My name's Scott Harvath, Secret Service. I was head of the advance team.
Boy, are you going to have some explaining to do. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes, snapped Agent Zushnit.
This guy's a real asshole. I thought this shitty treatment was reserved for muscling in on local law enforcement jurisdictions, or when the FBI got one-upped by the CIA.
Most of the FBI guys Scott had met in his career had been pretty decent. The Secret Service and the FBI normally got along quite well. This guy, though, was asking for it.
Agent Zushnit, I know you're doing your job, and I'm just trying to do mine.
If you'd done yours, the FBI wouldn't have to be here cleaning up your mess.
What's your fucking problem?
I don't have one. What's yours?
Harvath's pissed-off meter was now well into the red zone, but he fought to stay in control and keep his cool.
Over 2 dozen men probably have died on my watch.
And you want me to let you in here to contaminate this crime scene? Somehow that's going to make everything all right? Guess again, buddy.
You know, said Harvath, backing down, you're right. You've got a job to do, a post to stand. I can appreciate that.
If you couldn't keep one lowly Secret Service agent out, it'd probably make you look like a pretty big ass.
A smile spread across the lips of the beefy FBI agent as he smelled victory and saw Harvath turn to walk away. The smile disappeared when Harvath quickly spun around and delivered a blow to Zushnit's sternum. It felt like a red-hot ingot of lead that had been fired at him from a cannon. As the air rushed from his lungs and the agent doubled over in pain, Harvath placed his palms on Zushnit's shoulder blades and drove his knee up into the man's mouth, splitting his lip open and knocking him unconscious.
So much for professional courtesy, said Harvath,
as he ducked under the tape and walked up the hill to where several small flags had been placed in the snow. Blue tarps were pitched over the bodies to protect against further snow accumulation. Sealing the scene was the right thing to do, but there was no reason that Scott shouldn't have been allowed in. The scene was already greatly disturbed because of the rescue efforts. Snow was one of the biggest pains in the ass to try to gather evidence in. This case was no exception. As a matter of fact, the difficulty had been compounded by the avalanche, which Harvath now knew was no accident.
Scott moved from tarp to tarp, looking beneath each one, recognizing every face. The eyes of many of the bodies were still open, staring right through him. The pattern of precise headshots on all of the bodies, coupled with random bullet wounds on some, didn't make sense. He had a feeling that before this was over, he would be running across a lot of things that didn't make sense. Scott was trying to process the information as he walked over to one of the final tarps, under which lay the body of Sam Harper. He lifted the sheet of blue plastic and saw the body, with the Sig Sauer, clasped in Sam's right hand. A flood of memories poured through Scott's mind, and it was almost impossible to push them out. Whenever a president made an appearance on or near water, the Navy SEALs were called upon to provide support. Harvath had transferred to Dev Group after several years with Team 2, and was part of a contingent of SEALs that assisted several such protective details for a former president who loved to race his cigarette boats off the coast of Maine. Scott had proven himself to be extremely talented on many occasions, but when he discovered and defused a small explosive device meant to disrupt one of the president's outings, Secret Service agent Sam Harper stood up and took notice. Harper had been looking for someone just like Scott to help improve the Secret Service's protection of the president. He pursued Harvath back to Little Creek, Virginia, where Scott was an active part of the SEAL think tank. It took some doing, but Harper eventually succeeded in wooing Scott on board the Secret Service team. After Harvath completed his courses at the Secret Service Advanced Training Facility in Beltsville, Maryland, he joined Harper at the White House. Not only did Sam Harper show him the ropes, but he made him a part of his family. Scott had lost track a long time ago of how many barbecues and holiday dinners he had eaten with Sam, his wife Sharon, and their two daughters. The thought of how they would take this news tore right through his heart.
"What the hell are you doing?" came the voice of a very angry Tom Hollenbeck.
Without turning around, Harvath walked toward the last and final tarp, which he knew must be covering the man Harper had shot.
"Harvath, I asked you a question."
Scott lifted the tarp and stared at the bloody body. Half of the back of its skull had been blown away.
"What the hell's the matter with you? Assaulting an FBI officer? Damn it, Harvath, look at me!"
It took him almost a full minute to tear himself away from the body of the Middle Easterner. Silently, Scott was making a promise to Harper. He would personally deliver the bullets that would take out every last one of the fuckers responsible for this tragedy.
"Scorpion," said Harbath, so quietly that Hollenbeck almost didn't hear him.
"What?"
"The machine pistol. It's a Scorpion," said Scott, turning to face Hollenbeck.
"What about it?"
"They're manufactured by the Czechs, but are the darlings of every Middle Eastern group with a bone to pick."
"Speaking of bones, my friend, I've got a big one to pick with you. I know what kind of weapon that is, but I've got a couple of other questions. Just what the hell were you thinking when you cold-cocked that FBI agent?"
Scott shook off the melancholy trance that had descended on him when he had seen Sam Harper's body.
"He was asking for it."
"Asking for it? He was doing his job maintaining the integrity of this crime scene. You know damn well that in a situation like this, it becomes the FBI's purview."
"Yeah, when we call them in."
"And we have called them in. So therefore, you've got to back off. Our job now is to function in a support capacity."
"Doesn't that piss you off, Hollenbeck? Whoever did this breached our security, killed our men, and took the president."
"We can't be sure that he was taken."
"Not you, too. Come on."
"Of course it pisses me off, but that doesn't change the fact that the law is the law."
"We're supposed to be the best protective force in the world, none better. And yet, someone was able to just fly in here, wipe out our team, and then take off with the president."
"Scott, we're all in shock over this. None of us can believe it happened. You saved Goldilocks, though, and you should be extremely proud of that. We're all proud of that."
"But Tom, they took the president, our president. Not only are our reputations and the reputations of the Secret Service at stake here, but so is his life. We can't just sit back and do nothing."
"Scott, the cold reality is that he might already be dead. We have no idea either way. They could dig 4 feet in another direction and come up with him, though I doubt it. I actually agree with you. I think he's been grabbed, which is all the more reason for us to cooperate and play the parts we've been assigned. Now let's get you out of here. I'm going to have to do some fast talking to keep your bacon out of the fire, and I need a few minutes to think."
"Thinking is only going to waste time we already don't have. We need to act."
18. Senator David Snyder picked up the phone on the first ring, just as he had when it had softly rung hours earlier around midnight. Outside, a steady rain drummed against the windows of his Georgetown townhouse. Looking carefully to see if the figure next to him showed any signs of stirring, he spoke quietly into the phone.
"Yes?"
"Senator, it's Zushnit.
Zushnit? Jesus Christ! Hold on a second. I can't take this call here."
Senator Snyder pressed the hold button of the black Sony phone on the Oriental nightstand next to his bed. Very carefully, he slid out of bed. He put on a white Turkish bathrobe and a pair of Dunhill slippers and made sure to close the bedroom door behind him as he left the room. Snyder tapped the switch of the ornate chandelier that illuminated the gently curving staircase. Heavy clouds and steadily falling rain made the morning darker than it normally would be. At the bottom of the stairs, he crossed a marble entry hall and opened the front door to retrieve his morning papers. Wrapped in plastic were copies of the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, USA Today, and the International Herald Tribune. Even though his aides would clip any relevant articles for him at the office, he liked to get a jump on the day's news while he was still at home. Shuffling into his study, he could make out the headlines on several of the papers through the plastic sleeves. They all said more or less the same thing. Utah avalanche, president missing, feared dead. Snyder turned on the bank of television monitors in his office, which showed studio newscasters in suits speaking to reporters in the field who were garbed in heavy winter parkas with the brightly colored logos of their respective networks prominently displayed. The sets were muted, yet Snyder could tell the reports were coming from the site of the president's ski vacation and the avalanche. It was the biggest story in the country, if not the world.
He dropped his cord of newspapers on the couch next to the fireplace and pushed the on switch of the heat and glow remote. The fireplace crackled to life. If D.C. wasn't wrapped within a damp, bone-chilling cold, it was 95 degrees with 100% humidity. There never seemed to be a happy medium in this town for anything. Snyder moved around to the back of his desk and lit a cigarette. He didn't care if he kept Zushnit waiting. Salt Lake City was one of the largest FBI field offices in the country. This was due to the fact that at weapons facilities across Utah, America was honoring its nuclear reduction and disarmament treaties with the former Soviet Union. In the political chess game that had raged between the two countries for decades, neither had yet grown to trust the other, and consequently, the Russians had a large number of their people in Salt Lake, monitoring our dismantling and disposal progress, just as we had a large number of people in different sites throughout Russia for the same reason. With all of those Russians running around, the U.S. government felt it was a good idea to keep as close an eye on them as possible, and the job fell to the FBI. Always relying on his own inside sources, Snyder had cultivated many contacts in domestic and foreign intelligence gathering communities. While Zushnit might not have been the brightest bulb in the box, he had a nasty streak that Snyder liked, and the man had been easy to buy. Snyder now questioned whether giving him his secure home phone number had been such a good idea, but he reasoned it was better than having Zushnit call him at the office. "You're late," said a gruff Senator Snyder, as he picked up the phone and dragged on his cigarette. "I know, but shut up and listen to me first. Where are you calling from?" "I'm calling from the Salt Lake field office on the phone we used to route communications through from suspected fugitives and felons. It's the one that records all outgoing and incoming calls." "Where the hell do you think I'm calling from? You don't think I'm smart enough to use a secure line? I'm calling from a payphone at the resort." Controlling his anger at the man's insolence, Snyder responded, "Where at the resort?" "Near the medical facility, but don't worry. There are no other government staff around here. I'm the only one, and in my condition, I fit right in."
"In your condition? What do you mean?"
"I got sucker punched by a loose cannon on the Secret Service, some prick named Harvath. I guess he was head of the president's advance team."
"Not only head of the advance team, but he was also a member of the president's detail. You mean he's still alive?"
"Yeah, I guess he transferred over to the president's daughter's detail yesterday morning before the avalanche."
"Who else survived?"
"As far as we can tell, only Harvath and the president's daughter."
"Any clues as to the whereabouts of the president?"
"At this point, nothing. The Secret Service uncovered the body of a towelhead with a machine pistol, put 2 and 3 together and got 7, then called us in. The director of the FBI has Gary Lawler on his way out here. They are treating this as a kidnapping."
"And the media?"
"For now, they're being kept back from the scene. They've been able to piece together that several agents and civilians were killed in the avalanche, and that the president has not been recovered, but other than that, they don't know anything."
"Back to your getting sucker punched. What happened?"
"That asshole Harvath wanted to get in and take a look around where the president and his detail went down. The Salt Lake field office had directions to take over the crime scene and secure it until Lawler arrived. Nobody was to get in, including Secret Service. Shit, you should see how bad they had already trampled it. Anyway, Harvath insisted, and I told him no. When I wasn't looking, he sucker-punched me. That was a real pussy move."
"Yes, but he managed to get the better of you, didn't he?"
Snyder didn't expect Zushnit to respond. He refiled Scott Harvath's name in the back of his mind and returned to questioning the FBI man.
"Anything further to report?"
"Besides the fact that I took 3 stitches in my lip, my face is swollen up like a balloon and I'm lucky he didn't break my jaw, no, I guess there's nothing further to report."
"Then I guess that's all we have to talk about. I expect your next report to be on time, whether you have managed to get yourself bitch-slapped again or not. Am I understood?"
"Yeah, I hear you."
"Good.
What do you want me to do about the press?"
"Let me think."
For a moment, Snyder pondered when the right time would be for Zushnit to leak that the president wasn't buried beneath the snow, but had actually been kidnapped.
"You're still wearing your pager, aren't you?"
"Of course, all of the agents are."
When it's time for you to share our little story with the press about what has truly befallen the president, I'll page you and tell you how I want you to handle it. Understood?
Yes.
Good.
Snyder hung up the phone before the man could say anything else.
Simultaneously, the black Sony phone in the master bedroom upstairs was hung up by an extremely intrigued lover who hadn't been sleeping since the first covert call had come in around midnight.
19. Within seconds of meeting David Snyder, he could see why Mitch had found him so irresistible. The idea of his boyfriend sleeping with his boss to get ahead had never appealed to Andre, but Mitch had assured him it would only be temporary, and that it was just how things sometimes had to be done in Washington. Andre had sat by and watched what was supposed to be a one-time thing blossom into a full-blown affair between the senator and his junior staffer. To say it bothered him deeply would have been the understatement of the millennium, but Andre was in love with Mitch, and in love with the life Mitch promised the two of them would have together. The fact that Mitch had dated a lot of women on the Hill was no secret, and Andre had accepted that as part of their cover. But Mitch's deep involvement with Senator Snyder began to bother him greatly, especially when Mitch disappeared for entire weekends, or when the senator called in the middle of the night and ordered Mitch to hightail his little ass over to Snyder's townhouse. It had finally gotten to the point where Andre couldn't take any more. If he couldn't have Mitch all to himself, he didn't want to be in a relationship with him. It was bad enough that Andre had to hide the fact that he was gay, both at the D.C. law firm where he worked, as well as with his family. But to have to hide from the rest of the world the deep love he felt for Mitch was just too much. Andre Martin eventually reached his limit. He was through with living in secret, and he delivered Mitch an ultimatum. For the rest of his life, Andre knew, he would have mixed feelings about how he had handled the response. Mitch explained that he'd been trying to unwind himself from the affair for the past couple of weeks. The more he tried, the odder the senator became, distant and cold at times, downright inquisitorial at others. The senator's temper had begun to flare, something Mitch had never seen before, only heard about. Sex with the senator became rougher, almost as if the man wanted to hurt him both physically and emotionally. Even through all of this, it was important, Mitch said, for him to have an amicable parting with the senator, if he was to preserve his job. Andre felt he should be more important to Mitch than any job, and so to make his point, he moved out of the condo they shared. Andre knew he had done the right thing, but he was still racked with guilt. Mitch told Andre again and again how much he loved him, and that he wanted more than anything in the world to be with him. He stated that he was sure the senator was going to let him go soon. The treatment had become so bad that he couldn't imagine that the senator would want him around any longer anyway. Mitch even said he would give it just one more week, and if the senator hadn't ended it, he would. He promised Andre with all of his heart that he would do it, and asked him to hang on just until the end of the following week. In his heart of hearts, Andre believed Mitch. His spirits began to lift, and he decided that if the relationship was in fact ended by the following weekend, he would move back in with Mitch. Andre went so far as to make late reservations for that Saturday night for the two of them at their favorite restaurant, Monroe's in Alexandria. When Saturday arrived, Andre sat by himself waiting for Mitch, and while he consumed three lonely glasses of Chardonnay, he did a lot of soul searching. Realizing Mitch wasn't going to show, he paid the check and left Monroe's, convinced everything had been a lie. Mitch's job and his affair with the senator were more important to him in the end than Andre. He walked back to the Holiday Inn where he'd been staying since leaving Mitch and convinced the bartender, who was closing up, to give him a final nightcap. Andre slugged back the vodka and tonic, almost spitting it out when the partially astute bartender said, "Whatever she did, you'll get over it, pal." After draining a third of the tiny bottles in his makeshift minibar and cursing himself for falling in love with someone who didn't really care about him, Andre fell into a deep and dreamless sleep. When he awoke the next morning, his head was pounding, but at least that distracted him from the aching in his heart. He went into the bathroom, peeled the plastic sheet from around one of the cups, filled it with water, and chased down two Advil. Reaching outside his door, he collected his complimentary USA Today and the Washington Post. He threw the two papers onto the bed and returned to the bathroom, hoping that brushing his teeth would make him feel a little bit more human. After brushing his teeth, Andre crossed the room and sat on the edge of the bed. He quickly scanned the room service menu and picked up the phone to order breakfast. He didn't have the heart or the stomach to walk to one of the local cafes.
"Good morning, Mr. Martin. This is Tabitha. May I take your order, please?"
"I don't know how good the morning is, Tabitha, but you may certainly take my order."
He began reciting what he wanted, half looking at the room service menu and half skimming the Post's cover stories.
"I would like a pot of coffee, two eggs, and... oh, Jesus, no."
Andre had gotten to the small article regarding a drive-by shooting the previous night that had killed Mitchell Conti, aide to Senator David Snyder, and an as-yet unidentified man believed to have been a friend of Mr. Conti's.
"Mr. Martin, are you okay?"
asked the room service operator.
"Cancel my order,"
was all Andre Martin could manage, before rushing to the bathroom to throw up. Through some very low-key questions to close mutual friends, Andre tried to piece together Mitch's movements before the shooting. Everyone said that Mitch had been very down lately because of his job difficulties and because of losing Andre. Apparently, Mitch had been out with his friend Simon looking for a gift for Andre when the drive-by shooting occurred. The police assumed that it was just a classic case of wrong place, wrong time for Mitch and Simon when they were caught in a hail of bullets. But what the police failed to dig up was who the shooters were and who the assumed target was. Despite the initial public outcry, Mitch and Simon became just another statistic. But not to Andre Martin. Something was rotten in the capital of democracy. The whole thing smelled funny. There were conflicting accounts about the shooters, their vehicle, and nothing solid about the intended victims. The more Andre looked at it, the more he was convinced the drive-by was not an accident. He continuously replayed in his mind the things Mitch had told him about Senator Snyder, how he never lost and no one ever stood in his way. Andre also remembered the final message Mitch had left for him at the Holiday Inn, saying that he thought he knew of a way whereby the senator would have to cut him loose from the affair, but still allow him to keep his job. Mitch had bragged he might even get a promotion out of it, and then they both could celebrate getting their lives back to normal. Had Mitch been foolish enough to think that he could blackmail the senator? Had he thought the senator would end the affair and yet still allow Mitch to keep his job and maybe even go so far as to give him a promotion? It sounded like something Mitch might try. He'd always thought he was smarter than everyone else. On more than one occasion, Andre had told him he was too smart for his own good. No matter what Mitch might have thought he had on the senator, any way he came up against him, he would have lost. The more Andre thought about it, the more the drive-by shooting made sense if you assumed Mitch had been the intended victim. And the more the drive-by shooting made sense, the more Andre was determined to avenge the death of Mitch Conti. Even though it hadn't been easy getting close to the senator, Andre had eventually succeeded. While he didn't have the political network that Mitch had had, he was an excellent fact finder and quickly assembled his own dossier on the New York senator and the causes closest to his cold heart. Several months later, through a partner's wife at his firm, Andre was able to wrangle an invitation to the Gold Circle Ball of the International Diplomats Forum. At the black tie affair, Andre was every bit as striking in his tuxedo as Mitch would have been. He came to the event bolstered by a couple of martinis, convinced he would be able to seduce the senator. The senator had indeed noticed Andre, but it took coincidentally bumping into him at several more important functions before the two had a real conversation. Once they had their first date, Andre wisely played hard to get, acting unimpressed with the senator's lifestyle and power, which only served to set the hook deeper. Snyder was soon thoroughly taken with Andre and couldn't get enough of him. Jealous and insecure, he wanted Andre with him every moment. Lately, though, Snyder had seemed tense. None of the signs would have been visible to a casual observer, but Andre had been studying him long enough to know when something was afoot, and whatever it was very big. All of his experience as a lawyer told Andre that he could be in a lot of trouble snooping around in the life of one of the country's most powerful senators, but he wasn't after state secrets. He wanted personal secrets, and Andre knew the man was dirty. He knew he was responsible for the deaths of Mitch and Simon, and Andre wanted to hang him with that, if not something equally damning. He also knew that if Snyder ever caught on to him, an accident would happen just as easily to him as it had to Mitch and Simon. When Snyder had sneaked out of the house shortly after receiving the first strange phone call around midnight, Andre had known something important was happening. He'd let himself out a side door and caught the senator getting into a cab half a block down the street. The rain made it difficult to see, but Andre managed to get the cab's number and soon thereafter caught one himself. The senator was in a hurry and didn't take many precautions against being followed. Andre had no trouble staying with him. A half hour later, when the cab turned onto a posh residential street in McLean, Virginia, Andre knew where his quarry was headed. He told his cab to stop and watched the senator's driver say something into an intercom at the large iron gates of a brick Georgian revival. Moments later, the gates swung open and Snyder's taxi drove through. Satisfied, Andre instructed his cabbie to take him back to the townhouse in Georgetown. He lay in bed awake for the rest of the evening, pretending to be asleep when the senator came home. He didn't stir until Snyder got out of bed to take the second phone call. Now, in the overcast light of a rainy morning, Andre hung up the black Sony phone and rolled over to his side of the bed, contemplating the implications of what he had just heard. It was time to get up, and he thought a hot shower might steady his nerves. He walked into the bathroom and didn't even feel the radiant heat from the tiled floor on the soles of his feet. He turned the shower control to hot and climbed in, scrubbing himself with a lemon beeswax soap, one of the many bath products the senator liked to indulge himself with. His mind racing, he was so preoccupied he didn't notice his lover had entered the bathroom until the shower door swung open.
Andre, I think you and I need to have a little chat.
20. When Harvath and Hollenbeck had hiked to the bottom of Death Chute, there was a snowcat waiting to take them back to the command center. Once they were seated inside and were underway, Hollenbeck pulled a stack of Polaroids out of his parka and handed them to Harvath.
Ever seen one of these back in your SEAL days?
Harvath looked intently at the first picture. It was a box, painted white, about the size of the average surround sound subwoofer. By its appearance in the picture, it had been found buried in the snow. Scott flipped through the shots, which were taken from different angles. In some, the box was partially obscured by the branches of a pine tree it was under.
I don't know. Looks like a white box, Harvath said, handing the photos back to Hollenbeck.
When our guys found it, we had no idea what it was either. Our gut said it might be an explosive device, so we got the bomb tech guys up there right away.
Where? Up there? Scott asked,
gesturing over his shoulder back toward Death Chute.
I thought this was an FBI investigation now.
It is, but we were operating outside the secured crime scene under the pretext of discovering if any of our agents might have survived the slide.
But you said they were all accounted for.
Now they are. But we hadn't released that information to the FBI at that point. Listen, I don't want to split hairs with you. I busted your ass up there because that's my job. I've heard about that guy Zuschnitt. He's got a reputation with the FBI for being a real prick. That's probably why he got stuck posting the crime scene. Think about it. That's a pretty long rotation to be standing with your thumb up your ass in the freezing cold.
Harvath laughed at the image. It was the first time he had laughed all morning.
I guess you're right.
Damn straight I'm right. Now, I want you to look at these, he said, as he pulled another group of Polaroids from his pocket. Once we determined the device was not an explosive, we were able to discover that it was encased in panels and that the panels could be removed. Scott flipped through this set of pictures with greater interest. Each displayed a different exposed section of the box's interior, which contained densely packed electronics.
It looks like an airsick bag for a supercomputer that had a really bad lunch. There must be at least 100 circuit boards crammed in there. There could never be enough air circulation in there to keep whatever this thing is from overheating, unless
it was placed in the snow, responded Hollenbeck, who'd already come to that conclusion. He pulled some more photos from his parka and narrated as he flipped through them. The alloy construction of the box probably helped circulate the cold. There are also fans and a set of tubes with screened vents, which we think acted as a cooling system. Any guesses yet as to what its purpose is?
Judging from this picture, said Scott, pointing to the one Hollenbeck had just revealed, I'd say that little device there is a low-profile antenna. If you have your guys look up into the tree above where you found the box, at the very top, you'll probably find a camouflage transmitter with a booster.
Yep, that's exactly what we found.
So this device is a transmitter of some sort. I'd be willing to bet you may have found the source of our communications problems.
It was. We shut it down, and the radios and everything else came back online, clear as a bell. What do you make of this? Said Hollenbeck, as he removed a final Polaroid from the stack and handed it to him. Harvath studied it carefully.
The writing looks Korean. By the sophistication of the equipment, I'm going to guess this is something from our friends in the north. Most of the components will probably turn out to be Taiwanese, but the overall design and assembly is probably North Korean.
I had our communications guy look at it, and then I slipped Jim Bates and some of his White House Communications Agency people up to take a peek. They've never seen anything like it, but they're all guessing it's a very sophisticated jamming system.
But why did it jam our communications and not the CB radios?
It could be that proximity-wise they weren't close enough, or...
Tom, proximity had nothing to do with it.
Our radios were cutting in and out when we were on Deer Valley's main runs.
If this was an overall jam, the CBs would have been affected as well.
The other possibility Bates and his WHCA guys are kicking around is that the device can be tuned to jam specific frequencies at different intervals.
On for a minute, off for 20, Scott said,
more for his own benefit than Hollenbeck's.
It got us used to the on-again-off-again status of the radios, made us think it was some sort of natural anomaly.
Yep.
But for that, you'd have to already know at least what frequencies the Secret Service was using. And that's a closely guarded secret.
Exactly. So whoever was jamming had to have an inside line on the frequencies of not only our radios, but also Deer Valley's and the Smocks.
Deer Valley's wouldn't be hard to get, but ours? Are you suggesting a leak? No way. Not possible.
I want you to stay quiet about this, Scott. Understand? I don't want to start a witch hunt.
I wouldn't worry about starting it. Pandora's box is going to open all by itself. I'd be more worried about how you're going to close it.
21. A million things swirled through Scott's mind as he and Hollenbeck made the rest of the ride to the command center in silence. He felt like that painting, The Scream. The phrase, "You're only as strong as your weakest link," kept piercing the chaotic jumble of his mind. The idea that someone on his team had leaked information to anyone, much less a source with hostile intentions, was unfathomable.
Maybe the information wasn't leaked, Scott tried to tell himself.
The problem was, once it had been suggested that you have a leak, you become focused on it. It becomes hard to concentrate on any other possibilities. When the snowcat came to a halt, Harvath and Hollenbeck didn't wait for the driver to get out of his cab and come around back to open their compartment. They were on the ground and on their way to the command center before the man got halfway around the machine.
Tom, can I get my SIG back? Said Harvath,
who figured someone on the team must have secured his sidearm for him when he was brought in unconscious last night. As long as you promise not to use it on any FBI agents. It's in the lockdown cabinet in the command center. I left Longo in charge, so you can sign it out with him. Scott made his way to the extra-large Winnebago that had been brought in from the federal garage in Las Vegas to act as the primary communications and command center for the president's visit. While the house the president was staying in, just 50 feet away, was also loaded with agents and electronics equipment, This was the nerve center of the operation. Scott found Longo in back, bent over a laptop, clicking away at the keys.
Hollenbeck told me I could grab my SIG back from you.
Your what? Said Longo, distracted by the report he was working on. Written reports were the one thing Scott hadn't ever been able to get used to. The Secret Service loved their paperwork.
My SIG's sour. It's about this long, Harbath said, showing him with his hands. Blackish gray and fires these things we call bullets when you pull on the trigger. If you want to find an apple you think you might fit on your head, I'll give you a little demonstration of how it works.
Very funny. Glad to see your accident didn't damage your sense of humor. I'm sorry. The WHCAs have been crawling all over me about how the radios went down, and I've got to document every single thing. The report's got me hung up.
Since when does the White House Communications Agency give the Secret Service orders?
Those guys are Department of Defense, just in civilian clothes. Hollenbeck said to cooperate with everyone. He's really worried about how the service is going to... Hell, who am I kidding? He's worried about how the Secret Service already looks on this one.
We lost the president. I still can't believe it. Now the FBI's got their top pit bull coming in, and he's bringing the hostage rescue team with him.
The special agents in charge of both the FBI and Secret Service Salt Lake field offices have been on the warpath around here, and I'm just trying to keep my head low so it doesn't roll.
Listen, Chris, you're not going to lose your head.
You don't think so? Harvath, I hate to break it to you, but over 24 agents are dead and or missing. The president is gone, and we've got next to nothing lead-wise. Heads are definitely going to roll. You know, I like you, but as head of the advance team on this one, it looks like you might be married to King Henry.
Being married to King Henry was an inside joke that referred to the British king, who beheaded several of his wives after he had grown tired of them.
Chris hadn't needed to say it. That thought was one of many flying around Harvath's head, as well as a sense of crushing responsibility for the deaths of his fellow agents. Scott's only hope of getting out of this one with his career intact was to be part of some significant breakthrough.
"Here's your weapon," said Longo, as he turned from the cabinet, setting the pistol on the table and handing Harvath a clipboard. "Sign right here."
Scott strapped on his holster, handed the signed clipboard back to Longo, and walked toward the door.
"You know where the term severance pay comes from, Scott?"
said Longo, as he hung the clipboard on a peg inside the cabinet and locked it again.
"No, but you're going to tell me, right?"
Ignoring Harvath's sarcasm, Longo continued. "It's also from England. When prisoners were going to be beheaded, they offered the axeman a little extra money to make sure he chopped their heads off with one clean blow."
"Thanks. I'll be sure to remember that," said Scott,
as he held the door to the Winnebago open a little longer than he should have, eliciting moans and shouts from the cold agents inside. Crossing the compound toward the main house, Scott replayed the conversation with Longo in his mind. He knew that the other agents didn't blame him. Scott Harvath had been single-handedly responsible for ushering in some of the most significant improvements in Secret Service training and tactical procedure in years. But he also knew that as head of the advance team, he had to bear a tremendous amount of the responsibility for what had happened. Looking up at the sky and the still falling snow, Harvath felt that the agents not yet recovered by the search and rescue teams were a lost cause. The president, though, was a different story. He was probably still alive, and it was only a matter of time before demands for his ransom would be made. Scott thought about Amanda, lying in a hospital bed in Salt Lake, glad she would make a full recovery. He didn't dare think about what conditions the president might be languishing in at this moment. There was no question that Scott's career was probably finished, at least with the Secret Service. He would be transferred to a less sensitive posting, and would most likely be relegated to protecting Third World delegates on visits to the United States, if even. He definitely would never be allowed to head up an advance team again, or, for that matter, work another presidential protective detail. He could return to the SEALs. His teammates had always thought Scott was better suited to offensive operations than defensive anyway, but he was too proud. He couldn't go crawling back. Everyone would know that he had been responsible for the security arrangements for the president's ski trip. The SEALs were an honorable operation, and not something you ran back to with your tail between your legs when you failed someplace else. Failed. The word tasted bitter in his mouth. Had he failed? And if so, by whose definition? As a SEAL, failure meant giving up, not acting, throwing in the towel. The Secret Service might begrudgingly accept a sideline position while the FBI came in to run the investigation, but that didn't mean he had to. The more Scott considered his options, the less he could see he had to lose. The Senate inquiry, which was bound to come down eventually, would tie him to a stake and roast him. There would probably be other sacrificial lambs, but he knew that back in Washington, they were already engraving his invitation to the party. Even if he resigned from the Secret Service before then, he would still be forced to testify at the hearing and be roasted nonetheless. They would need someone to blame. It was part of the pathological makeup of politicians. The other thing gnawing at him was the oath he had taken to protect and serve his country and the president. As good as the FBI was, it would take them a hell of a long time to get everything coordinated. By then, evidence would be lost, and the kidnappers would be even farther away. The FBI would have to wait for demands to be made. They would continue to go through the motions of looking for evidence, and if they were lucky, they might turn up a lead. But Scott wasn't holding out a lot of hope the FBI would catch a break. There was no question in his mind that the president was still alive. If the intent had been to assassinate him, his body would have been found along with those of the rest of his detail. There was a lot to be said for a collective effort, but when that effort was not quickly coordinated and executed, 9 out of 10 times, it ended in disaster. The FBI and the Secret Service were playing defense. Every cell in Scott's body had been trained for offense, and offense called for action. Besides, he thought again, what did he have to lose? 22. Scott found Vance Boyson and Nick Slattery at the edge of the perimeter, leaning against the flatbed of a Deer Valley avalanche control truck, checking their equipment. Vance had been a friend of Scott's from his days on the freestyle ski team, as well as an important contact during Scott's sweeps of Deer Valley for the president's visit. Vance noticed him approaching and dropped what he was doing to greet him.
Hey, Scott, how you feeling, man?
I've been better, fellas, replied Scott.
We heard you took a really good spill down the mountain.
Wasn't anything worse than I've ever eaten off a jump.
Nick stopped his equipment check and turned to join the conversation.
Is there any word yet? There must be 1,000 ambulances up here, but we haven't seen any of them go down. That's not a good sign.
No, it's not good, said Scott. Listen, I need a favor. Now that the weather's a little better, can we get your bird up?
Vance looked at Nick before responding.
Sure. Where do you need to go?
I want to go up top on Squaw Peak to get a better look at where the avalanche started.
Nick sucked in a big breath of air between his teeth.
The sheriff has told us that area is off limits until further notice.
I'll take full responsibility. The sheriff doesn't even have to know. If he says anything, you inform him you've been directed by the Secret Service to lift one of their agents up there for further investigation.
Agent Harvath, you're a cool guy and everything, but I don't...
Nick was interrupted by Vance. Of course you don't want to interfere with a federal investigation. If Scott says he needs to get up to that peak, then he needs to get up there. We were told from the beginning to provide the Secret Service with any and all assistance they required. Well, this agent needs assistance, and he's going to get it. Vance winked at Scott and said, get in the truck. Deer Valley's chopper was primed and ready for takeoff when they arrived at the helipad off the main access road. Scott and Vance spent the short drive talking about the equipment they would need when they got up to the peak. Most of it was standard gear that the chopper already carried, but when they came to a stop near the pad, Vance shouted instructions to Nick above the roar of the rotors. The chopper rose rapidly, and looking down, Scott could make out the flurry of activity below. Because of the route they took to get to the helipad, they had bypassed most of the chaos. Now, though, Scott could clearly make out the battalions of rescue vehicles and news trucks parked pell-mell along the roads. As the chopper continued to rise, Scott discussed with Vance the details of the avalanche while he slid into a pair of Deer Valley yellow and green ski pants Nick